Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over the last 25 years, the internet and technology have revolutionized the world. Our personal and professional lives have become dependent on companies like Facebook, Google, and Amazon. It is incredibly difficult to disconnect. The original concept for the web was created by a physicist named Tim Berners-Lee back in 1989. And at that time, he envisioned a democratic web that would promote autonomy and collaboration. But instead, the web pivoted toward the corporate version we know today. In his new book, The Know-It-Alls, today's guest, Noam Cohen, chronicles the political rise of Silicon Valley, from its early developers to the multi-billionaires shaping the internet today. He shows how radical individualism has gone mainstream, and he profiles a handful of tech oligarchs ruling so many of our lives. He argues that Silicon Valley's vision for society is libertarian and often very cruel. It's one where each of us, in the words of LinkedIn's founder Reid Hoffman, is a startup of you, struggling in a hyper-competitive market without the protection of unions, government regulations, social programs, or all too often even basic decency. Noam Cohen covered the influence of the internet on the larger culture as a tech columnist for the New York Times, and Noam Cohen joins me in studio. Hi, Noam. Welcome to the show.
Nice to be here. Glad to be here. Yeah.
Yeah, it's great to have you. Mm. What struck me about your book is there's so few critiques of Silicon Valley. I mean, I get the San Francisco Chronicle, and almost on a daily basis, the business section is talking about driverless cars or the 10 companies to watch. Why do you think there are so few critiques of Silicon Valley?
I think we were talking about it, how people love the services, right? And it is a tricky thing that, you know, Uber, we're talking about how helpful these services are and how, in general, these are great goods that you're getting. And I think people don't see the negative, right? I mean, it's kind of like the analogy that's been coming up more and more, I think, these days is kind of like the robber baron era, where you don't see the, you know, what are called the externalities, the pollution, let's call it, that's being caused by these great things that are good that you're getting. That, so that if Gmail is giving you a free service, I use it. We're talking about, we're on Facebook Live now, another service. We're not paying for it, right? Mm-hmm. So, but the costs are coming to all of society. I think that's kind of, it's been hidden from people until lately. And I do think this, the kind of influence of the election is changing things a bit. Maybe not so much here, but I think around the country, I was looking at hearings in Washington, D.C., that there are much more criticism of what's going on, many more questions. But I think in general, the costs have been hidden and the benefits have been really well advertised.
You started writing a column for the New York Times about these issues in 2007. Talk about how your opinions about Silicon Valley have been shaped over the years.
Right. I wrote in the business section, but I would rarely write about businesses. It was always kind of odd. I'd write about Wikipedia. It was like a real personal obsession of mine. I just couldn't believe this incredible source of knowledge was created by all these volunteers. It kind of spoke to a lot of the kind of vision I have, almost anarchic, of people working together as a community. I would go to these events around the world where you'd meet the people behind Wikipedia and realize these were just very ordinary, interesting people who are doing this thing for a greater good. So that really spoke to me. I was very, my idealism. And then, of course, it's harder to hide what's going on when you sort of see the tracking. And I think, like a lot of people, it was like a train crash in slow motion. You sort of, I have Gmail, and you kind of realize that, you know, they're kind of reading your email and giving you ads about it. It's a little, seems odd. Now, they would say they're just reading, robots reading it, but not them. But it, little by little, it leaked in. I have to sort of step back and see what effect are these companies having? And I guess I also wanted to, I notice, as like a lot of us have, that there's a real libertarian view that has become more acceptable. What used to be a very fringe idea to think that we're all in it together, like you said, that it's a startup of you, is suddenly considered a great thing. You can be your own driver and you can just work for yourself all the time. It's like, well, the reasons why unions exist to give you protections, the reasons why we band together and we're not all out trying to become billionaires or live in poverty. It's a really very dark vision and I did not like it. So that's why I wanted to write this book. I wanted to sort of stop back and be a critic because there aren't many. I was definitely struck by that.
And one of the main points you make is that these tech companies, the mostly men who run them, are so focused on radical individualism. So it's all about, you know, we're going to change the world and you can do anything. But as you write, without the protection of unions, without government regulations, without social welfare programs, and in many cases, without basic decency.
Yeah, I think one thing that was a real turning point for me in doing this book was reading this feminist philosopher who kind of argued that libertarianism itself kind of requires devaluing women, and that it's not a coincidence that it's tech bros and not tech sisters. That you, it kind of, to be a libertarian, truthfully, you have to believe that you have kind of arrived in the world fully formed, and you weren't part of a family or with a mother often raising you, and that you, everything you made is yours alone. And I think that's kind of the fallacy that the internet is kind of creating of a whole new world where there's no racism and no sexism. It's part of the whole attraction. It's very adolescent, male adolescent, I would say. You'll see in the book I talk about how looking at kind of the male adolescent attributes of these grown men who are into sci-fi and fantasy and kind of dream of going to Mars, and you sort of wonder why. Like, why, you know, why would you want to settle Mars when, you know, or Earthify Mars? What's it called? Terrify? I don't know. Rather than actually make Earth inhabitable. So that was kind of a turning point for me to realize that it's kind of the misogyny is endemic, and the racism is going to be ignored because they believe they're creating a new world. Mm. It's very scary to me, yeah.
Can you talk more about that? Because I was a tech reporter right out of college. I love how you write about the history of Linux and Mosaic, the first web browser. I mean, I was addicted to that browser in the library. It was one computer had graphics back in 95, and I think I shut the library down every night. And back then, it really was about, wow, we're going to share this information. You can talk to people in other parts of the world. You can learn about other people. But it shifted really quickly.
Right. I think we were talking about Tim Berners-Lee, and he is one of the heroes in the book in that he had a vision for – it's also individualistic. I guess that's the thing about libertarianism. I'm not like – obviously I believe in personal freedom, and I want people to express themselves. And his early browser insisted that it was really a form of Wikipedia, that you would be able to edit. It was vital. It was not passive. It was active. So the shift that happened, I think you're talking about, is when Mosaic, it became a passive, an entertainment vehicle. And which is very good for business. And, you know, they would say it's what people want because people did choose the Mosaic browser and eventually Netscape. But it's more that it was lost, this idea that you could interact with it was something you controlled and that you're not part of an ecosystem that's owned by a company, which is where we are today, where Facebook really wants to be considered the equivalent of the internet. It's pretty scary.
It is amazing how quickly things have changed and how incredibly wealthy these men have become over the past, I guess, two decades or so, right? Talk about how that shift happened from the Tim Berners-Lee, who really focused on a democratic internet that was inclusive, to what we have today.
Right. I guess maybe one way to talk about it is, like, I look at Wikipedia as being the exception to it, right? I found a real irony in the book doing the research for it that Google, right, was created by these – I really were genuinely idealistic young PhD candidates at Stanford, right, Sergey Brin and Larry Page. And they wrote this paper that was very influential. It talked about how search engines should never have ads. It was antithetical to the mission. Over time, Stanford, I think the ethos there pushed them to become a company. And we have Google today, this massive corporate entity with full of ads and tracking. Now, Wikipedia was founded by Jimmy Wales, who was a real businessman. He was a trader. He was trying to make money. He put Wikipedia together as part of a company he had that was about what we call Web 2.0 company. It was trying to create content. And, of course, the irony is that he didn't have the connections and the access to all these venture capitalists. So in the end, Wikipedia, and it used free software like you're talking, in the end, Wikipedia had to become free. I explain in the book why, you know, every attempt to advertise in Wikipedia was bound to fail. And the irony is that basically it became the one free source. I think there are these powerful institutions that were the venture capitalists in Stanford that were really encouraging this along. And Wikipedia almost proves it by exception, because this thing that was found in like Florida, not part of the venture capital system, is the only thing that became this free site and non-tracking site. So,
and not everyone followed this path, because I love the story of Craig from Craigslist, who in 94, 95 was sharing cool things to do with friends, and then it exploded into a website with jobs and apartments. And he was contacted by corporations many, many times who said, let me put a banner ad on Craigslist. And he said, no. And then there were offers to buy Craigslist. I mean, the guy could probably be a billionaire by
Absolutely.
Now.
And,
he just said no. And what I love about Craigslist is the look has never changed. Mm. It's still very old school tech, and it's still very, it's a useful tool.
Right. And I would say he's not inclined to do bells and whistles, and he doesn't use kind of the AI to try to, like, yeah, keep stickiness. It's more like the reason why he turned it down, is all the money you're talking about, is that he really always put the customer first. And he also considered, you know, it's funny, you meet Craig, when I was a reporter, I met him out here, and he has his card, right, his business card will say consumer service agent, right? I mean, that's his, he's proud of that. And the thing that's really interesting about that, and kind of what you're talking about with the website, is that another real enemy or real problem is scalability. This idea that you have to keep growing in order to make money. Now, if you have 2 billion users of Facebook, how in any sense can it be a human interaction? It can't be. You can't. They're not fielding 2 billion phone calls about my problem or like, hey, this ad bothered me. They're going to try their best to use algorithms. But Craig really always wanted to keep it on a human scale, and that's something really special, and it's because he didn't want to make $1 billion. So you're totally right, yeah.
Today we're speaking with Noam Cohen, former technology columnist with the New York Times, who's out with a new book called The Know-It-Alls, The Rise of Silicon Valley as a Political Powerhouse and Social Wrecking Ball. You can find information at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. If you work in tech, how would you describe the culture? And how do you think technology has really changed the way you work and interact with fellow citizens, the way you consume information and consume news? And what do you think about the power and the influence giants like Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, Peter Thiel? Peter Thiel is the venture capitalist who founded PayPal and who was one of the major Silicon Valley CEOs or tech titans who supported Donald Trump. Give us a call, 866-799-8888.
This is an encore presentation of Your Call. We're not taking calls right now. Thank you.
8255. How do you think we can push back against the monopolization of tech companies? How do you think they can better address discrimination? What do you think about the libertarian bent and this focus on the individual? 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. What are your thoughts, Noam, about this focus on the individual? It's about me. Sometimes I get in debates with friends about Uber versus a cab driver and a union cab driver versus an Uber driver who has a really hard time making ends meet. And they say, well, it's fast. They pick me up. It's cheaper. I mean, this is what you hear all the time, is that I'm busy and I just need to use these services because they're fast.
Yeah, I guess I come back to the idea that the social costs are kind of hidden. And I know it's not only unique to the internet. I think about Walmart, too, where you'll hear that Walmart employees are on food stamps because they're not making enough money. And, like, that's us as a society, you know, subsidizing Walmart paying low wages. Or, you know, or the damage that Walmart will do to Main Street America or whatnot. But this was a similar thing where, you know, yeah, in the shorthand, it is definitely more convenient. But we as a society have to collectively look what's best for us, because we're going to all pay for the pollution that's going on. And I would say that the election really was a big wake-up call, I thought, because when people saw, you know, it wasn't just, I was saying in a talk that, like, you know, in the past, to be a critic of Silicon Valley, be like, you know, is your smartphone making you dumb? Or, you know, or do young people care about privacy? I'm really worried about that. But more abstract, not as central as, is our democracy compatible with these tools? And when you talk about individual, stressing the individual, I think about, like, how, let's walk through the whole Facebook and how it's helping people stir anger and dissent and what they're really doing. When I was talking with a friend about this, it's like also the fact that it's not transparent, and it's not, we don't all see the same ads, right? They're targeting your neighbor will see something you aren't seeing. And that's just a very dangerous thing because it's breaking down community. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg talks so much about community, but community is a physical thing, how you live, who you live next to, how you take care of each other. And if you're not all kind of seeing the same reality, it gets very scary, I think. So that's a real, we're not, you know, I think it's sinking in. I really am more optimistic that it could be changed. I think people see the damage more clearly than they ever have.
Optimistic for change?
I am, because I think this election, I was watching these hearings that were going on in Washington, where they were really questioning the the general counsels for these companies, for Google and Facebook and Twitter. And they're in Republicans as well as Democrats were asking very hard questions, particularly one Republican from Louisiana was really asking, you know, does Facebook keep track of people who are depressed or overweight? And would you sell that to advertisers? And he was really calling for some kind of accountability that you can't just – we as a society have to regulate this. You can't just let Facebook do whatever it wants with its powerful tools. So
you focus on Mark Zuckerberg. You have a couple of lines here about Sean Parker, a former Facebook president who staged a multi-million-dollar wedding in a redwood forest in our beautiful Big Sur, and it was landscaped to look like Middle Earth of the Lord of the Rings. And he got in a lot of trouble because they did a lot of damage to that environment there. Sean Parker was speaking recently. He's now chair of the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy, and he was speaking about advances in cancer therapies recently. He said that when Facebook was being developed, the objective was, how do we consume as much of your time and conscious attention as possible? And I'm reading from The Guardian now. It was this mindset that led to the creation of features like the like button that would give users a little dopamine hit to encourage them to upload more content. He says it's a social validation feedback loop, exactly the kind of things that a hacker like myself would come up with because you're exploiting a vulnerability in human psychology. And so he's basically saying that Facebook is exploiting human vulnerabilities.
Yeah, and there's a whole chapter on Mark Zuckerberg, and you know, and he was different than some hackers. And he also studied psychology, and yeah. So it's funny that Sean Parker would say, like, I as a hacker would know about the dopamine hit, but you also say someone interested in psychology would know about that dopamine hit. I think it's really hard to unpack like the Mark Zuckerberg story because I begin talking about how he was a young man. His first program was about a Julius Caesar game, and I think, you know, in a lot of ways he's sort of dreamed about world domination, you could say. And I think a lot of computer programmers had that. And you say you've been in that world. There's an interesting book I read that talked about like the closed world of a computer. That it's this world where you can be in total command, up is down, whatever rules you make on your screen are true. And that's one thing for a programmer. But to see it spill over to real life, I think Zuckerberg has seized a chance to really have that kind of control over the world. I think what's interesting is that I'm not prepared to say whether he believes his own mythology or not. I mean, I think he says that he thinks connecting people is a good and that he will use tools like these dopamine hits to get people to join up and that in the end he's connecting the world. I think he might not know what is important in the world or we might differ about that. I think there's a weird thing he wrote in one of his letter to his daughter about his values. It talked about like we can experience 100 times more things in a given day. I don't even know what that means. I don't know if for him, virtual reality is the same as reality, and you could see 100 sunsets a day, and is that 100 times better than seeing one beautiful sunset? I don't think so. But so I don't know what he really believes, but it's definitely not what I want, the person I would want to be in charge of our society or world, for sure.
A new study just came out from the Institute for Policy Studies that found the three richest people in the United States, Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, and Warren Buffett, own as much wealth as the bottom half of the U.S. population, or 160 million people. And of course, there's that Forbes list that comes out every year. And I guess Zuckerberg and those, they kind of shift around, but net worth, almost $70 billion for one person.
Well, it is the flip side of saying you're not going to catch people when they fall is to say that if you win in the contest, you should get everything. It's really not how you would organize a normal society. It's not how you would – the reward seems so disproportionate. I mean, like looking – from reading this stuff and looking at the history like I do in the book, you could say that the Google invention was like a special invention. And they did something very special. I don't think that's worth whatever, $70 billion at all. Facebook is a lot about a monopolistic behavior, and it really ends up rewarding just the fact that they've been ruthless in buying competitors. So, yeah, it's just all out of whack. I think that's something people don't talk as much about. That it's just an out of whack. Why our society allows that? It's just mind-boggling. I mean, on a tax level, it shouldn't happen. But anyway, I'm with you all the way.
Noam Comb is the author of the new book, The Know-It-Alls, The Rise of Silicon Valley as a Political Powerhouse and Social Wrecking Ball. Let's hear from Caroline in Mountain View. Hi, Caroline. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much for having this show, and thank you for having me on. I have a question. I'd like to hear the writer comment about the distributed system of the Internet. Projects like IPFS, Rubin's projects with consensus. And that's a distributed version, and their distributed version of Facebook, where you don't have a centralized party controlling all our data and all our info, and it's more distributed with a distributed internet system. and hopefully it'll come to a point where we have Caroline actually owning her medical records on herself, on her own blockchain, owning my shopping behavior, owning everything, all my data. I own it, and it's distributed around the whole, you know, universe, and I can access it from anywhere in Singapore, in Mountain View, or in, I don't know, Timbuktu.
Yeah, I love it. I think it's funny that you make this point about kind of controlling your own data. Because as I've been on this book tour, I've been kind of asked, what you point out the problem so well in your book, and I'm so enjoyed it, but where do we go now? And it's a hard question. And I think often I talk about breaking up the companies or having more regulation European style. But I was talking with a friend who also, controlling your own data, maybe that's a better narrative, a better way of seeing this fight, instead of like being these, you know, startup companies being stopping the government from regulating them. Let's think of it that we should own our own data and why, and it's very valuable. I've seen there was recently an op-ed that talked about taxing this data, the wealth created by this data. But I mean, what you're saying makes perfect sense. It's the way your medical records are, you should be able to see what do they know about you. And you should be able to say, I don't want you to know that about me. Give it back to me. Or I'm cool with you knowing, because that way I get better ads or I get better book recommendations. So I'm really happy you have this data and go for it. But like, it should be our decision. And it was funny. I was looking back in the history. In the 70s, there was a commission that was put together under Nixon. And one of the characters in the book, Joseph Weizenbaum, was on this committee. And was supposed to talk about privacy and records. And I think they initially recommended that corporations should also be under this rule, that you should be able to get your data back. But in the end, the only law that was passed was about government. But I think that'd be a perfectly great solution to say that corporations should respect your data and give it back to you.
You write that when Mark Zuckerberg was asked if Facebook should be regulated by governments the same way the electric and water companies are, he replied, in terms of regulation, I mean, we get regulated by users, right?
I love that quote. Yeah, I think that speaks exactly to the arrogance and the kind of, and on two levels, the arrogance that like, we know how to regulate ourselves better than you, and also what I call the greed, the entrepreneurial, leave us alone, we're going to, don't get in our business. Both aspects. But yeah, I think they believe they're popular, therefore they're good, and they're good, therefore they're popular. And it's just,
and also we know best, because you have so many quotes from these guys who believe that they can disrupt education, they can disrupt the media. And we did a show maybe 5 years ago about Mark Zuckerberg spending $100 million to completely, quote, reform the education system in New Jersey.
Newark, yeah.
Without even talking to parents
or teachers. I don't think he'd even been in Newark. He'd never been to the city, let alone a school. Yeah, it's a pretty amazing concept, yeah.
Yeah, and this is kind of across the board. I mean, you've got examples in here about a lot of these guys who think they can do it better than like workers, like government employees or people who've dedicated their lives to these jobs that pay like 60 or 70 grand a year, right?
Yeah.
Where does that come from?
Yeah, I think it is a kind of a computer. Like I was saying, that closed world of thinking you can make it work on your screen, therefore you can make it work in the world is obviously, and I think that's part of the attraction to certain, you know, young adolescent minds, is to think that finally it all makes sense. I can just, there's no kind of, it's a real, you know, it's a real bummer to think you have to deal with a legacy of racism and misogyny. Like who wants to, you want to like think you came to this world, new world, and no strings attached. It's like, but it's very, clearly doesn't work. It didn't work in Newark. Partly, I read the book about that time. And one of the things he thought it all could be incentives, that you just gave money for the ones who did the best work. But it's like, truthfully, being encouraged by a principal had your back meant as much as money. So probably they look at the world like that we're all like kind of maze rats who just give pellets to, and that's how we'll perform, without seeing that being part of a community is so important. Yeah, I thought that was a great example of what's wrong with them.
Thank you for the call, Caroline. Let's go next to James in San Francisco. Hi, James. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say first off that like I appreciate this topic, and I agree with everything that you're saying for the most part. But I'm curious why single out Silicon Valley and why single out tech? Because it seems like this is just the story of corporations in every industry, right? It's like you see generational wealth, you see incredible greed, and it's like you get names like Carnegie, Stanford's, or Bill Gates wasn't even an internet, right? So it's like the Silicon Valley and the startup culture that we see now is kind of unrelated.
I totally hear the question. I mean, I don't agree with it. I mean, because I think there is something unique and special going on here. There is an intrusion into our lives that is unprecedented. And obviously, trains were super important. And there were these robber barons, and you know, including the person who set up Stanford, and then they got regulated. So there are definitely analogies here. But, you know, clearly we're seeing, like, with the divisiveness that's going on in our culture and people, there's a kind of been a graph that's been making the rounds of Twitter about showing the polarization of political views in America coinciding with the rise of social networks. You know, I hear you, but I just think these are really powerful tools that are way more into our lives, that are deal with the dopamine hits and all the things that Sean Parker was talking about. It'd be nice to think it's just another company, another example of greed, but it is something that is happening fast, and it's changing our society. That's part of what I'm arguing in this book. It's like it's also changing our political values, and it's encouraging hyper-individualism. I don't think, again, trains or telephones quite had the same ability to split us up like that. Arguably, trains brought us together. Maybe you'd say trains let people go on rides far away from their homes, and that's true too. But these tools are really kind of feeding people a line that they can be a startup of themselves and to not care about their fellow citizens, and that's very dangerous. It's just different. I wish it wasn't. I hope I'm wrong, but I think it is of a different nature.
Well, thank you for calling in, James. We'll continue on that question, and we'll ask Noam to elaborate right after the break. Noam Cohen is a former technology columnist with the New York Times, author of The Know-It-Alls, The Rise of Silicon Valley as a Political Powerhouse and Social Wrecking Ball. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line. Your call at kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation with Noam Cohen, author of The Know-It-Alls, The Rise of Silicon Valley as a Political Powerhouse and Social Wrecking Ball, we'd love to hear from you. If you work in tech, give us a call. How do you think tech has changed the way you work, the way you interact with your fellow human beings, and the way that you consume information and news? You can email us, yourcall@kalw.org, or give us a call.
This is an encore presentation. We're not taking calls right now. The show is not live. It's pre-recorded. And thank you.
Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for this book, this interview. I just wanted to take the history of the internet a little bit earlier and suggest that everybody view a documentary called Das Net by a German, Lutz Dambeck, came over here and interviewed the people who were in the origins of the internet, where it arched out of the ARPANET that was developed within DARPA and then brought into the popular culture through art galleries and the Whole Earth Catalog and made into something that could be like interesting to people. Sort of marketed. So I just wanted to put that in, you know, for an additional interesting look at the internet. That's all I've got to say.
All right. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, you should know the book does deal, not quite with that history, but clearly DARPA comes up, but it deals a lot with the history of computer science, because there's the first chapter is about the person who came up with the idea of AI and artificial intelligence. And to me, it was very important because this is where a lot of the thought of people as machines and machines as people and thinking of brains as being these individual units that can be detached from a body and AI, you know, is a term we hear talked about all the time now. I want to go back to the origins of AI because back when it started, it was an idealistic, like you're saying, a government project, government funded. I think there was a dream of creating this greater intelligence that could actually answer important questions. Like John McCarthy, the Stanford professor who ran the AI lab there, had a dream that actually computers could like explain the cosmos if they got smarter than us. They weren't going to be our overlords. They were going to be our help us, because knowledge is good. And, you know, what's happened over time is that these ideas of AI have been used. They just imitate people and they manipulate people. So it's really a whole 360, you know, a whole switch of 180 on what AI is about. And it's really become about manipulation rather than something noble about trying to, you know, more science to help the world and government-funded science, not privately funded science. So
the Chronicle had a piece recently about how AI scientists are pretty scarce, and so they're being paid up to $500,000 a year or more in salary. Since you're bringing this up, what is the point of driverless cars, in your opinion?
It's fascinating. I mean, I think there are a couple of things. First off, it's amazing. From the book, I was reading about these early labs, right? And they've been working on driverless cars for more than 50 years. I think partly it's like this irrational mind that says, God, it's so irrational to have traffic lights. I just wish it could be. Why that's an obsession, I don't know. I think partly you think about someone, they were talking about Peter Thiel, and who has a dream of living forever, right? And he's very upfront about it. He thinks we're strange for not wanting to live forever. He believes it makes sense. You should not want to die. And I do think they look at traffic accidents as a thing that could be avoided because that kills people. I think there's some part of it as well. But I don't know why. It is kind of like removing the human, the holistic idea that you drive a car is interesting. You stop, you look at things, and seeing it in just transactional terms.
It's always strange to me, though, because there's so many stories now about homelessness in Silicon Valley, massive poverty in Silicon Valley. A lot of contractors who work for these companies cannot make ends meet. And yet these guys are pouring hundreds of millions into driverless cars.
Yeah, I do think it's... It's also like this idea that believing that engineering is going to answer all our problems. And there was a hero in the book named Joseph Weizenbaum, this professor, who basically said for him, particularly math was easy. Math answers very easy questions. The questions like homelessness and how do we live together as society, those are the hard questions. If you really think you're so smart, if you're a know-it-all, could you help us figure out how we can get along as society and get rid of racism and misogyny? That would be really – I would be saying you are a smart person if you could figure that out. Figure out how to like map a driverless car. It seems like there's thousands of people interested who can do that, and not very interesting. I mean, it's not really a tough question. Some ways are taking the easy way out, and I kind of cite that quote that the wise man knows he knows nothing. I mean, if they really believe they're so smart, they should have a little more humility, I would say. Anyway, well, sounds like a good grade. Yeah.
You brought up Peter Thiel, and in the book you call him a one-man wrecking crew who has been sowing chaos through American society up to this day. He was one of the few, if only, major Silicon Valley executives who publicly supported Donald Trump. And you write about Peter Thiel when he went to Stanford. He started the Stanford Review to give a voice to conservatives on campus. You have so many tidbits about Peter Thiel, who came up with the idea of PayPal back in the day. What really struck you about what you learned about Peter Thiel?
Well, I guess partly I think in some ways he's always been identified as this outlier. He's the libertarian, and we're not like him. And I wanted to argue that he's really of the same worldview as these other ones. Reid Hoffman and he are kind of the LinkedIn founder, are kind of famously friends from Stanford, and they're like on opposite sides. But to me, you know, Reid Hoffman writes Startup Review and has very extreme views about individuality, and so does Peter Thiel. And I guess I just, in telling his story, I wanted to, show that it came from a very, he has very extreme views. I mean, he's famously written an essay that, I want to quote it kind of accurately, but basically bemoaned that women, or thought it was bad for capitalist democracy, that women and people on welfare get the vote. This book that he wrote with David Sachs in the 90s was a very extreme view of multiculturalism and very harsh and cruel at times, this book, if you read it. And I give lots of excerpts from it in the book. So I just see him as a the kind of person who speaks most honestly, and that in some sense he takes a lot of the flack and lets them kind of cover and say they're not like him. The other thing I thought was really interesting about Peter Thiel is that he's very upfront that monopolies are good. Like, he talks about how the goal of a company should become a monopoly, because a monopoly makes lots of money. If you're in true competition, you're not making any money because everyone's lowering the price. So a lot of ways he just really lays out the blueprint that smart, rich people should run the world. They should use their powers to get more power. And, his support of Donald Trump, some ways people view it as him just being cynical and, like, hedging his bets. Like, no one else was publicly going for him. I'll do it. That way I'll have more clout. But also I think it just, in some ways, Donald Trump, it's easy to see everything as Donald Trump embodying every bad problem in our society. But he really is a kind of, the know-it-all approach. He's not like them. He's not overtly smart and overtly a hacker. But, only I can solve the problem. And, like, I think that's an attractive top-down, that democracy isn't something that's organic that leads to a leader like our president. But instead, it's like you get a plebiscite, you get a vote, you voted for me, I do whatever I want. I think that's attractive to Thiel also.
The book you cited that he wrote with David Sachs was published in 95, and it's called The Diversity Myth. They wrote, the primary problem for multiculturalists is that there are almost no real racists at Stanford, or for that matter, in America's younger generation. This was in 95.
That's a quote that's held up well, I think. Yeah, yeah.
Well, and then he wrote an essay for the libertarian think tank, the Cato Institute, in 2009, he wrote that the 1920s was the last decade in American history during which one could genuinely be optimistic about politics.
I think, to be fair, he wrote that in 2009, and then the Trump elections give him new optimism. But back then, he was really glum and thinking we'd never get someone quite like Donald Trump who could really cut through all the, the special pleading. So, yeah, and I there's one other, like, thought that happened at Stanford back then, which is that, he was a real proponent of this kind of criticizing what he called political correctness. And I write about in the book about how at Stanford in the 80s there was an attempt to try to rein in the hate speech that was on the internet. It was before the web, before there were, Twitter, obviously, well before that. And there was an attempt to say, this particular Usenet group had racist jokes that were very harsh, and we want to stop it. And, you know, it wasn't Peter Thiel. It was the computer science department led by John McCarthy that said, you know, the internet needs to be totally free. And it's like, I feel like Stanford and, you know, and Peter Thiel is a product of Stanford, is this Wild West approach to the internet, which we're still paying the costs for. Because, again, it's very attractive, but it's got real costs.
You know, it's also just amazing to – I mean, we read about these wealthy men. Again, the Forbes list of the richest people in tech. Bill Gates, $84 billion. Jeff Bezos of Amazon, $81 billion. Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, $69 billion. I mean, you can't even comprehend that kind of money, right? Mm-hmm. It's also amazing to see how much money these guys make when their companies go public. So you write that Peter Thiel PayPal, he made $55 million from
that. You understand, from Facebook, he made, you know, what is more than $1 billion wealth from Facebook. He was the first outside investor in Facebook. You know, invested, I think, $500,000. And, you know, it's obviously multiplied so much. Yeah, it's just, and, you know, you can view it as like just collecting all the pennies and nickels from around the world and just kind of, I sort of say it's like a pool table. It just all goes to the side pocket in the Bay Area. You know, I mean, it's amazing.
What's so obscene is, I mean, we have listeners who live off of Social Security, right? $1,000 a month, maybe $800 a month. And then you write about what some of these guys do with their money. Peter Thiel was publicly outed as being gay in 2007 by ValleyWag, one of the Gawker family of websites that write about celebrities, right? And so he got really angry about that, rightly so. He didn't want to be outed. And he decided to take on Gawker Media. And there's a documentary about this. Can you tell us the story about how he connected with the wrestler known as Hulk Hogan?
Right. Well, so I think you might, it kind of reminds me of one of the calls we had where I guess he looked at it and saw a bug. He saw a flaw that Gawker did to him. I guess he didn't feel he would sue over. I mean, that's a question. Like, obviously, if he was wrong, that we should have a court system that would let him sue about how he was treated. But instead, he saw this flaw that there was some behavior that Gawker did that was really quite extreme, where they published a sex tape, and there were depositions in the case that were really where the Gawker editor really said things that were not inclined to make a jury like him. And so anyway, he secretly, and eventually came out, gave funding for Hulk Hogan to launch a lawsuit that allowed eventually bankrupted Gawker. So it was a very clever, you know, hack of the legal system to get this ends. I mean, you know, he's opaque about, you know, I think he felt he wasn't doing it for himself. He claimed he was not mad at them. He was just doing a good for society by getting rid of the site. But yeah, it's a very, it obviously raised lots of chills because he was a very wealthy person using his money to go after a publication that he was angry, you know, had reason to be angry with.
It's incredible that if you're wealthy, I mean, you can take down a media organization like that.
I think it kind of, in light of all the, we were just listening right before this show, there was all discussion of the Harvey Weinstein case, and you can't help but think that the New York Times, where I used to work, have such great lawyers, they have such, you know, resources, and they were able to convince people, because one of the things that the reporters were talking about were these non-disclosure agreements and convincing women to say, this can't be what an NDA is about. Mm-hmm. You have to talk about wrongdoing. And it's one thing you need strong publications that are not scared, but they're not, you need smaller ones also to be, have confidence too. Yeah. It's a scary event. Yeah.
Today we're speaking with Noam Cohen, former tech columnist with the New York Times. He's out with a new book, The Know-It-Alls, The Rise of Silicon Valley as a Political Powerhouse and Social Wrecking Ball. Let's go next to Phil in New Mexico. Hi, Phil. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks. I'm a 20-year Silicon Valley veteran who, after the last dot-com crash, went into self-exile, if you will. That's why I'm in New Mexico. But at the time, I worked through the first dot-com boom, and I worked at Cisco and 3Com, et cetera. And so I got a perspective on that to share. But the main point that caused me to call in was Noam's repeated citation of Joseph Weizenbaum. Mm. And Joseph Weizenbaum, most people don't know him. I was one of the first AI researchers, a really interesting German a Nazi refugee at MIT. And Weizenbaum in the 60s took a moral position against speech recognition technology. Weizenbaum said that no moral computer scientist should work on speech recognition technology because if it were ever perfected, it would be and put in the hands of Big Brother or big government that the Orwellian possibilities were unlimited. And I have watched over the last 5 years as speech recognition technology has made major, major leaps, and it's been celebrated for the most part, particularly by technologists. And as you guys talked about, the general press, the business press, is pro-technology all the way. Anyway, what no one has commented on about high accuracy speech recognition technology is what a government like China is going to be able to do with that. With, you know, practically 80-90% of Chinese have cell phones, and all you need, the scaling, once you've got the basic algorithms down, you can scale speech recognition just by adding more hardware. And as I said, I'm looking at Noam's article on Silicon Valley is not your friend, and I've been waiting for somebody to point out this Orwellian potential of speech recognition technology. And if I could have just one last comment that goes to Noam's point, you know, as I said, I worked in Silicon Valley from the early 80s to the early 2000s. And at first, you think it's libertarianism, but it really isn't. It's selfishness. Libertarianism is the fig leaf that the people use to justify their selfishness. And one beautiful case in point is the United Way of Silicon Valley in 1995 went bankrupt because of lack of donations.
Wow.
Well, I first of all, a couple of those points, I mean, Phil, one is that, like, I'm trying to argue that libertarianism as it's currently constructed is selfishness, because libertarianism is predicated on the idea that it's a fair fight, whatever, a fair market. And so any ideology that claims that there should be not deal with the inequality is itself, obviously, so it's selfishness. So I don't think it's quite a big distinction there. And your other point, I did read that stuff about speech recognition and Weizenbaum. It was with McCarthy. They had this debate about it. I remember reading that stuff thinking, well, you know, maybe McCarthy was right, because it is being used for Siri and a lot of other things, and it wasn't simply being used for Big Brother or big corporations. But I hear you. I guess it is scary. I don't know. When people ask me, I don't know how you put these technologies back in the bottle. That's always the question that Weizenbaum, I felt, couldn't really quite address. Like, he definitely, you exactly described him right. I find he's in the book a lot. I really find him a real hero, because he was taking a moral view about this stuff. But I don't know how you stop scientists from doing this. And I think it's almost like we politically have to come to terms with it. It's not going to be easy to say, don't look into these things. It's more, but politically, we're going to say, we're not going to tolerate this. We're not going to collect this, allow this data to be collected, rather than say, don't let a technology that collects data happen. You know what I mean? I think it's almost like a political solution rather than a technological solution. But you're totally right, and I know what you're talking about.
Well, thank you for calling, Phil. We've got just under 10 minutes left, and I want to make sure we talk about a couple other men in your book. Jeff Bezos. Let's talk about Jeff Bezos. He owns Amazon. He now owns Whole Foods, and he now owns the Washington Post.
They always make a distinction that he personally owns the Washington Post, but Amazon, the company, owns Whole Foods. But
well,
no,
this is
totally
a lot of power.
Absolutely.
Now, tell us a little bit about him, because as you write, he's not a tech guy. He was a finance guy.
Yeah, I was writing this book. I have this idea that it's about Stanford and computer science, and McCarthy and this character named Terman, who was a Stanford official who I feel is very important. And I knew the book was kind of coming together, and I was really excited when I saw someone like Jeff Bezos, who he's saying is not a hacker. People point out, why is it even the book? He's not in Silicon Valley, right? Amazon's located in Seattle. But in fact, he has this connection, because he got turned on the internet through someone named David Shaw, another a secretive person who founded a hedge fund called D.E. Shaw, something called Desco, which he took. So he was part of McCarthy's lab. He studied AI and computer science, and he did research for a little while, but then eventually became one of the early quant investors. He used computers to analyze imperfections in the market to make, again, billions of dollars. And so that gave a thread, because that's where Bezos kind of he came through that world. And there's an article back in the early days where David Shaw talks about how the two of them discussed that someone could become a middleman for the entire commerce of the internet. And so it's kind of well known that when you think of Amazon starting out with books, but it was very clear that was a strategy from day one, that books are a good way to start and get a beachhead. People are very loyal to books. Books can be kind of in warehouses and deliver them. You're used to that idea. And then he speaks to a real conscious strategy long term to dominate this area of e-commerce. And I think the Whole Foods step is are they trying to dominate offline commerce? And they'll stress that in the total commerce, Amazon's still not a giant, but it's, to me, it's worrisome to take your monopoly position in one place online and try to keep moving offline.
I didn't know, but I was interested to learn that Jeff Bezos and his partners in 1994 were choosing between Seattle and somewhere in Nevada to put Amazon. California was out of the picture because of its sales tax.
Yeah, and that's obviously something that even Donald Trump will often, that's an awkward thing when you find Donald Trump is sort of making similar points, like your point about Bezos and Amazon having this connection to the Washington Post. So that just because Donald Trump says doesn't mean it's not true. And he points out, I think they answer that. In fact, they've actually evolved on sales tax, I believe, that like
they had to, right?
Right. But also, I think now it almost becomes a competitive advantage. They're cool with paying sales taxes. Other people can't start up. But yeah, they're always were thinking about dominating the marketplace. And that was what it was about.
So we have Jeff Bezos worth, according to Forbes, $81 billion. Again, Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett own as much wealth as the bottom half of the population in the United States. That's 160 million people. And over the years, there have been a lot of really good reports about how Amazon workers are having a hard time making ends meet. And I'm just finding this World Socialist website has information from the International Amazon Workers Voice, and it looks at 28 centers. Seven are full-time warehouse associates. One is seasonal. In fact, when I was on Twitter this morning, I saw an ad that said, seasonal help wanted. Work from... It was something like 12:30 at night until 7 o'clock in the morning. And the average pay is $12 to $14 an hour.
Well, I'll get a little like religious here a second, a little bit, because partly what you're getting at with these points is this efficiency and this bowing down to efficiency. And I was almost thinking at the beginning of the book with a quote from the Bible about the idea of gleaners and this idea that the Bible says that when you harvest the field, you're not supposed to go back a second time and get what little scraps you missed. You're supposed to leave that for the gleaners or poor people, presumably, who can eat it. It's something a little obscene about a lot obscene about trying to extract every penny in values or even the idea of working only with contractors or part-time employees. What is that? I mean, what are part-time employees supposed to do when it's not Christmas? I mean, I understand efficiency is really important, and that's kind of what we're talking about with Uber and other things. But, I mean, is it really beyond the pale to argue that there are other values that could trump efficiency? I mean, anyway.
Well, yeah. And also the point is they're making billions of dollars, right? Mm-hmm. You didn't write a lot about Elon Musk, but you did write that Elon Musk captured this non-political perspective in a post in 2012 on Twitter. He said, I'm neither anti-conservative nor anti-liberal. Just don't like groupthink. Ideas should be considered on their own merits.
Rose, you picked out every great quote there. I love it. These are all ones that I like would have cited myself. I talk that all the time, this politics of non-politics. And yeah. I think Elon Musk in that quote like kind of goes on, and it's on Twitter, goes on to sort of say, yeah, I take ideas from both sides. Like, I like liberal ideas about gay marriage and, you know, legalized pot. I like conservative ideas about fiscal responsibility and low taxes. And it's like, that's just libertarianism. It seems like you're being open-minded, but it's really just a very coherent, you know, ideology. Own it. Don't say it's not political. I mean...
Well, and what's interesting is people praise Tesla for their electric cars. Tesla was very quick to say, we'll go to Puerto Rico and put down solar panels, which they did. But then you have a lot of reporting in the last month. Here's one from Bloomberg. Tesla is a hotbed for racist behavior. Tesla production floor is a hotbed for racist behavior, says an African-American employee who claimed in a lawsuit. He's saying that black workers are dealing with pervasive harassment. Another piece from CNBC. The U.S. agency in charge of enforcing labor laws just recently filed a complaint against Tesla, saying it found merit to workers' complaints about unfair labor practices. So again, you look back to how people are treated and these companies.
I do think, and also in the Bezos chapter, I talk more about the Times piece that talked about white-collar employees. And his response, I thought, was really telling because he said, this can't be going on because these employees will get other jobs if we're not treating them well. And you often will hear that about women being underrepresented in tech companies. Be like, well, if that was true, then there'd be a company that would just only hire women programmers. They would be so successful. They would pay them a little less because they need jobs. I mean, they just think of it all as a truly fair frictionless market with no history, no structural problems. It must be very comforting to look at the world that way, but we just see that it's just not real.
On the issue of wages, what do you think it would take to pressure these companies to actually pay workers a living wage? And we can have a whole debate about what is a living wage right now in Silicon Valley. I mean, if you're a janitor or a cook, what is a living wage, right?
Yeah, I think that they look at the bottom line. I don't know why they don't do more. Like you're saying, the way they define good being good actors and using their money for good does not seem to relate to the community so much and the people right around them. I don't know what will change that other than kind of collective action, collective response to this, and sort of non-acceptance. You know, yeah.
And how? I mean, since you've finished the book, you've been going on book tour. When you talk about this hyper individualism, how do you tackle that one?
Tackle it, meaning how do I?
How do you take it on?
Oh, I do think. I mean, yeah, I think you need to emphasize community building. Yeah, and not in the Zuckerberg way of because I think it's a long answer, but it's a real tricky question. I think it's not quite just turning off your devices, but yeah, looking around you and being empathetic and mindful, and definitely kind of shedding the very hyper individualistic approach. These devices encourage. You have to somehow break it. Yeah.
And where do you see us going? I mean, as we're all so connected to all of these
tools. I am
tools.
Optimistic, like I say, because I think the Russian election has given the fact that democracy is at stake, and people are sort of see that and are worried that these secretive companies and secretive algorithms are controlling how people might vote. And, you know, I think the politicians are waking up too. I have some reason for hope. I think it was much more abstract argument when I started the book 2 years ago. I think today it is speaking to a better audience, so I'm hopeful.
Noam Cohen is a former tech columnist with the New York Times. His new book is The Know-It-Alls, The Rise of Silicon Valley as a Political Powerhouse and Social Wrecking Ball. Noam, thank you for coming in. Thanks for your work.
It's a real pleasure. Thanks, Rose. Yeah.
Nice to see you. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.
On the next Your Call, hear the story of Crossett, Arkansas, where citizens are fighting for their lives against Georgia-Pacific, the paper and chemical giant owned by the billionaire Koch brothers. Experts have linked toxins from Georgia-Pacific's paper mill to high rates of cancer in the town. But when residents turn to the EPA, they don't find the relief they need. Hear the director of the documentary Company Town and one of the people who fought back on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.